I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, inventing a way out of the higher education mess. The scariest movie trailer you're going to see this summer isn't about zombies, asteroids, or body snatchers. It's about the crumbling of the American university system. It's called Ivory Tower, and this is the tone of it.
Our nation's combined student loan debt has now hit $1 trillion.
College tuition has increased more than any other good or service in the entire U.S. economy.
It's like a subprime mortgage broker that ripped you off.
Original balances in the tens and 20,000s of dollars, ballooning up into hundreds of thousands of dollars.
If I do ever have kids, my private loans will be directly passed to them, even if I die. It's a nightmare.
The government will make $184 billion off our kids trying to get an education.
Coming to a theater near you, Ivory Tower, this summer. And what you heard is just the money piece. Consider the evidence that college students drink more, study less, get better marks for learning less on the best American campuses these days. There's also the fact that the social project of expanding middle-class opportunity is in reverse now. Have-not families can't afford college. Most of the low-income students don't finish. When the symptoms of distress run longer than a Letterman list, we thought it's time to start fresh with common sense, but with real inventors of a different learning process. Consider New You as an affordable gateway to imaginative life, citizen life, work life, the eternal prizes that come with education. Shai Reshef joins us from South Korea. He is the founder and president of the University of the People, the world's first tuition-free, online, accredited university. It has students from Nigeria, South Africa, Haiti, all around the world, in fact. His goal is to make sure that every student who is ready and able has the chance to earn a university degree. Shai Reshef, you beat us to the game of inventing a new one. What's the most important feature of yours? Is it the universality, the fact that it's free, or the record so far that people finish their courses?
Well, hello, first of all.
Welcome.
I think that the most, thank you. I think that the most important element of what we're doing is showing that there is a way to enable every qualified student to get higher education in affordable price. We believe that first and foremost, we help the students, but we also show a way for other universities. We build a model for other universities to replicate, and even more so for developing countries' governments. So it's basically opening the gates to higher education for every qualified student.
This is not a MOOC, and explain why.
Well, it is not a MOOC because we put our students in a classes of 20 to 30 students. We have students from 143 countries. Many of them came from hardship. We have survivors of the genocide in Rwanda, of the earthquake in Haiti, of the tsunami in East Asia. And for all these people, after what they've gone through in their life, they won't be able to make it if you put them in a class of 20 or 30 or 40,000 or maybe more students. They need personalized attention. So the only way for them to succeed is to put them in small classes, make sure that they get the attention they need and follow closely what they do. The result are showing the difference. If the MOOC has about 5% graduation per course, we have over 95% graduation per course. And by the way, if you look at the demographic of the MOOCs, most of the people who use the MOOCs are people with previous degrees and people who actually are coming from affluent backgrounds. So it's a different setting. I mean, I think the MOOC is a great thing, but it's not the same thing.
The curse of the MOOCs has been that people drop out. What is the stickum in your University of the People that keeps them in?
I think it goes anywhere between, first of all, people who take the MOOC take it in many cases as enrichment, as a supplementary. In our case, it's a degree program. Mm-hmm. You need to be accepted. You need to follow all the requirements in order to continue with us. So first of all, there is the structure. You don't do it just in order to have the knowledge. You do it in order to get eventually a degree. Second, it's the setting. It's a small virtual classrooms of 20 to 30 students with an instructor in every class, with peer-to-peer learning, which actually help to motivate the students, and academic advisors as well to help the students progress and give them the help they need.
The M in MOOC is for massive. It's a huge audience with coming from a central place. Yours is non-massive, and you have individual attention from faculty proctors, so to speak. I want to know about the faculty. They're unpaid, they're volunteers, they're obviously dedicated, but how do you monitor them? How do you choose them? Where did you find them?
Well, you know, I guess that we should go a step back to the day I announced the university in 2009. I announced it in a conference. The next day we had a page about it in the New York Times, and days after it, we already have hundreds of professors sending us emails saying, we believe in your mission, we want to be part of it. So we have over 3,000 professors who came on board to help our students. Our Council of Presidents is chaired by John Sexton from NYU, include the Vice Chancellor of Oxford, the President of George Washington University, the Chancellor in Berkeley, et cetera, et cetera. All those people who came on board to help us. When we need someone to either write a course or to instruct, we choose among the 3,000 volunteers. So we have a huge pool of professionals. We do not use all of them. Actually, the majority of them are not being used for the very reason that we don't need that many. But we choose the best out of those who volunteer, and then they get into the classes. We check them very carefully, both their background before we take them, but as they teach, we survey our students every single term to make sure that we are up with the standards that we want to have.
Shai Rishav, I want you to describe what you saw as the problem that you and these distinguished teachers all wanted to solve together.
Well, you know, I spent over 20 years in for-profit education. Among other things, I started the first online university, for-profit online university, outside of the U.S. in Europe. There, I witnessed how powerful online learning can be, because we had students from all over the world. They kept their jobs, stayed at home, and still get this quality European education. But at the same time, I realized that for most of the people, it was nothing but a wishful thinking. It was too expensive. I ended up selling this university and looked around and realized that actually higher education can be much cheaper, because all the ingredients are available to make it accessible. To point one fact, UNESCO stated that in 2025, there will be 100 million students deprived from higher education just because there will not be enough seats to accommodate them. So people will graduate high school as they do right now, and many of them being qualified for higher education but cannot do so, either for financial reasons, and universities are expensive. We all know about the U.S., but actually worldwide. In many cases, there are not enough places in the existing universities, and this is the very case in most of the developing countries. Students take a placement exam, either they in or they out. If they out, it doesn't mean that they're not qualified. It simply means that there is no room for them in the existing universities. There are a lot of personal issues. There are political issues. There are cultural issues. Women in Africa are being deprived from higher education in many countries. And I believe, and so do the many, the thousands of people who came on board to help us, that there was not a better reason for the invention of the internet and spreading the knowledge worldwide and making education accessible to all. And that's what we're doing. We open the gates to higher education for every qualified student, actually giving an opportunity for those who have no other.
I'm getting the idea. Shai Rishav, stand by. Say hello to Margaret Daugherty, who's in our studio. She's finishing her PhD work in English literature at Harvard. She's been active in the Harvard teaching campaign, mainly to keep class sizes small. She'll be teaching writing at Harvard in the fall. in the non-ladder faculty, as it's called. Not tenure, but not an adjunct either. Maggie Daugherty.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi, it's nice to meet you.
Hi.
How much of Shai's University of the People could you imitate in Cambridge, which we love to think of as the frontal lobe of the universe, probably more postdocs per square inch than anywhere in the world?
Yeah, we can use that to replace the People's Republic then, probably. I think one of the really wonderful things about this project, the University of the People, is its attention to the diversity of students. And I think that's a goal that many educators at my institution share. I think it's a goal of educators at other institutions. And having a base in Cambridge, we obviously could not bring students from all of the countries that this project is reaching out to into Cambridge.
Online you can. But could you assemble free education with volunteer faculty in this part of the world on some of those principles?
I think it's the volunteer aspect of that equation that gives me pause. I'm concerned about the idea that because someone feels passionately about the cause of education, that should be something that they offer out of goodwill, and that they should not be compensated economically, that they should not be provided benefits for performing that kind of labor. So asking people to volunteer their time and energy and work in that way is probably not something that I'm ready to advocate for in our current situation.
Are you ready to choose between the alternative MOOC online model and the seminar table?
I don't know that it needs to be a choice. I've used both of those forms of education in my classroom, and I think they can speak to each other in productive ways.
We're bent on finding out how many of the ills of higher education could be solved by starting over with a fresh evaluation of outcomes and satisfaction, without the virtually professional but money-draining sports, with an open, tough-minded assessment of what digital technology can do that lectures, even seminars, don't do anymore. Sebastian Thrun is the model of One Way Out. He's the big ideas man at Google. 3 years ago, his idea was to take his graduate class on artificial intelligence, for which Stanford students pay big money, and put it online for free. It was the first MOOC and the start of a craze in massive open online courses, a craze that has cooled and evolved in Sebastian Thrun's company called Udacity. But Sebastian Thrun is still charging away from the model of exclusive Stanford toward a setting more like a Hollywood studio. He's investing in star professors who can make learning as enticing as a blockbuster movie and an unshakable lifelong habit in problem solving, brainstorming, learning by failing. Sebastian Thrun spelled it all out for me on the phone this week.
I think we should really go and experiment with new ways of education. The system that we have today, the degrees and the way we teach, has really been defined before even the car was invented, before modern technology existed, the telephone, the television, the internet, mobile and tablets. With these new technologies, there's an opportunity to do so much better than existing delivery methods, and there's an opportunity to go to scale and reaching so many more students. You might remember when we started Udacity, we had a class that reached 160,000 students. That's never happened before in a physical setting. Now we can really make classes amazing because we reach millions of students.
How do you hang on to them?
Getting them to finish has been a major challenge in this world, and we don't really deny this. When we started out, we had a finishing rate of about 3%. Now we are at about 60% or 70%. One of the big game changers has been for us to really give people kind of human contact, not just the computer program, but individualize and have mentors that work with you through this process. But we've done many, many other things to make this just a much better medium.
You speak about gamifying education, making it as addictive as video games. What are you recommending to us, to a new you?
I recommend to every university to relentlessly focus on the student experience. And the video game is kind of an analogy I'm bringing in because, to some extent, obviously Angry Birds in these video games and Candy Crush, they aren't really teaching you something useful, but they're teaching you something. And you learn by exploration, you learn by interacting, you don't learn by a professor teaching you the rules of Angry Bird for the first, 90 minutes. And as a result, students playing these games get a level of engagement that is very rarely seen at a regular college class. We should just be relentless. We should relentlessly optimize for the quality of the student experience so that learning becomes addictive. It should really be an addiction to learn.
You also speak of education as a medium, something like radio or television or movies, comparable. What do you mean?
Part of what we do is certainly a content medium. When you look at how technology has transformed certain media, then you can find analogies, for example, between theater and movies. In the theater stage, because of physical limitations, it was organized very much like a classroom in that small groups of actors would perform for a small audience. And the economics would work the way that we couldn't really afford making these plays really, really great in most cases. And then, of course, movies came along, and it became perfectly okay to spend $100 million on one movie because 100 million people might watch it, and it's just $1 a person. That same consolidation has not taken place in education quite yet, and I think we're at the beginning of that happening. We have superstar actors, but we don't have superstar professors or superstar teachers quite yet. But I believe through digital media and through Udacity and other companies in this space, we will see certain professors emerging as absolute superstars.
How would a superstar teacher, what would he look like or she look like? I mean, we're talking movie star, acrobat, comedian.
I think we already have one example, and that is Sal Khan with Khan Academy. Sal Khan has reached tens of millions of high school kids and taught them college math and other things like history. And while this is just the beginning, it really shows that a single individual with a great personality and great smarts is able to really transform the lives of tens of millions of people. Now, if you go fast forward, how does a great actor look like? Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise? They're just really amazing characters that amazingly are able to engage people. I think that level of engagement is what we're striving for at Udacity, and I think it can be achieved.
What do you learn from Michael Sandel's rock star standing as a philosopher in Asia, in China, in India?
I'm just completely blown away by what he's done and how it has really crystallized an entire generation of young people in this field to have a rock star professor. That kind of model to me is the model I'm after, where we really take and make the production quality so good that the sheer enjoyment of being educated trumps the enjoyment of watching television, for example.
Do we know the secret? I mean, I've known Michael Sandel for years. I never saw the rock star in him.
I think in the world of acting, there's actors that are great for a Shakespearean stage, and there's actors who are fantastic for movies, and they're very, very different. Their personalities are different. Their styles are different. We know, for example, online, that the sheer lecturing of people is, by and large, relatively boring for most people. But if you make it more interactive and engage the student actively into the learning process, you not only get much better learning outcomes, but you also kind of mesmerize and engage the student in a much, much better way. So that we know, and we have lots of data on this. We know that a dialogue often trumps a monologue. People talking about a subject matter engages you more than being confronted with a face that makes you sometimes a little bit uncomfortable. So there's tricks you can inherit from the news media and bring into the teaching environment. But the most important thing that we really have learned, and Udacity has really internalized as part of our DNA, is it's all about the student. It's not about us. It's not about how we look and what we do. It's about the student. It's about student exercise. It's about student empowerment. It's about student projects. And when we go to the student and say, we let you do something and we help you yourself to develop those skills, then we win. I think in the end of the day, learning will fundamentally transform. Learning will become much more lifelong. It become much more of a fabric of our daily lives. Today, universities, when they're done with you, they shake your hand and they release you and they stop servicing you. I think the future university will be there for you from the very beginning, almost when you're born, all the way to the end, and really help you to retool yourself, to stay up to date, and so on, and to keep make learning kind of a prime thing throughout your entire life.
That was Sebastian Thrun, father of the MOOC, CEO of Udacity, at the bleeding edge of a new education adventure. We're back live with Shai Reshef, who started the University of the People. He's in South Korea tonight. And Maggie Daugherty in our studio. She's a graduate student and a teacher at Harvard. She's helping us think up a new university here in the old university capital. Paul Tough joins us. He's the author of How Children Succeed. He's a journalist working the gritty side of the education beat. In last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, his article asked, who gets to graduate? He found that too often, it's the rich who graduate, the poor who don't. Paul Tough, you could gather that Sebastian Thrun thinks the problem is somewhere in the way learning is presented to students, something in the medium, or the language, which sounds old-fashioned or uncool. You studied the students. What's your reading of what they're getting, what they're missing?
Well, my reading is that for a lot of students, a pretty traditional college is still working pretty well. So I spent a lot of time reporting this story for the Times Magazine at the University of Texas in Austin, which is in some ways a very classic old school college. It's one of the biggest flagship state universities in the country. It's very popular right now. It's got an increasing number of students applying to it. It's bigger than it's ever been. But I felt like the students who I was talking to, they were getting a lot out of the experience of being there. The problem was, and I think it's a broader problem in higher education in the country as a whole, there is this real divide between the experience that low-income students are having mm-hmm. in college, in higher education in the United States today, and the experience that higher-income students are having. The rich kids are going to different colleges. They're going to the most elite colleges, and they're graduating in high numbers. And the lower middle class, working class, poor kids are mostly going to less selective colleges, and they're mostly not graduating. So what I'm most concerned about is how to make colleges more inclusive. And I tend to think that's not mostly about technology. It is more about efforts that the colleges make and that we all make to try to make those schools more inclusive, to make them feel more welcoming, to change everything from, you know, the financial aid that students receive to the kind of messages that they hear to make them feel like this is a place that they can stay and graduate from.
What is the message they're getting? What is the message they're missing? And also, I got to ask, I mean, how much of the dropout rate hangs on the fact that higher ed is expensive? What if it were free? Would a lot of those kids stay? But what? Back to the social message, too, that seems to be discouraging them.
Sure. Well, I want to try and answer both of those. So the answer to the question of how much it is about messages and how much it's about money is a great debate, and it's certainly both. If you look at the way that financial aid has changed just in the last 15 years, it is now actually going more to both institutional and federal financial aid is now going more to wealthy students than it is to poor students. Hmm. And especially elite colleges are more likely to give aid that they call merit aid rather than need-based aid. And that's partly because they want more well-off, high SAT-scoring students. So it's a real problem. But I think there is also this question of these more, you know, psychological ideas about fears, about ability, about a sense of belonging that students have, a sense of that the university reflects their own culture. And I think as especially elite universities are becoming more and more places of concentrated wealth, students who are not rich, when they get to these colleges, mm-hmm. often feel like they don't belong. They are, you know, if you're a student who hasn't grown up in a college-saturated environment where your parents went to college, where everybody from your high school is going to college, where you've been talking about college at the dinner table ever since elementary school, it can be very overwhelming and disorienting to be in a place where everybody else is thinking that way. And so what I write about in the Times Magazine story is that at the University of Texas, they are experimenting with ways to make those students feel more connected, to give them the kind of confidence, the kind of sense of belonging that will allow them to bypass those fears that they sometimes have.
Paul Tuff, I wish you'd push back on Sebastian Thrun's point that some combination of technology and showbiz can cure the dropout problem. I mean, if we had Michael Sandel's and Brad Pitt's sort of teaching, if we transform the classroom as we've transformed theater, we'd get to our goal.
I mean, I think those changes would be great, and I think absolutely there are a lot of professors and lecturers and courses that are just boring and are not including students in the way that they need to. But I also think that especially for first-generation students who don't have college in their background, a lot of what they get out of college is not necessarily about the information they're receiving in the classroom. It is also about the experience of hanging out with people, students who aren't like them. It's about the experience of you know, organizing their time, getting papers done on time, figuring out how to study, figuring out how to learn, figuring out how to ask a professor for help. All of these are the kind of skills that you know, I think a lot of rich kids get earlier on, and that are going to help any of these students when they go out into the real world after college. And so I worry that anything that pushes us toward a more a MOOC-like environment where kids are staying at home, staying in their neighborhoods, not physically getting together on a campus, in a classroom, they're going to miss out on all of those other dimensions of education that turn out to be really important for every student, but I think especially important for first-generation students.
Shai Reshef, I wonder how you assure your students that they belong there, that they're welcome, that this is for them, that they must stay.
Let me just start by referring to the earlier point that you raised about the MOOC. Well, we're talking about having stars in the classroom as a solution for the issue. Well, but that's what the MOOC do. They have hundreds of courses. All of them are being delivered by the best professors in the field, and still we have 5% retention or 5% graduation, because this is not enough. You need the personalized attention. You need the support. You need the exchange that students need to have with each other in order to study. Now, the way we do it, and we put the students in a virtual. Whenever students is being accepted, and in order to be accepted with us, you need high school diploma and good enough English, sufficient English. And assuming that you are qualified, you are being accepted, and then the students are being put in classes of 20 to 30 students. In our case, they are from 20 to 30 different countries. So every time a student takes a class, he meets 20 to 30 new students from 20 to 30 new countries. We believe that this way we open their mind, we actually create a shift in attitude toward the world and toward their peers. But while they're studying, it's a very, very intimate interaction and experience. So let me describe a week just to make sure that we get it. So one of the 20 students, let's say that he's Chinese, goes on Thursday morning, and our week starts on Thursday, ends on Wednesday. Thursday morning, our Chinese student goes into the classroom, and he finds the lecture notes of the week, the reading assignment, the homework assignment, and the discussion question. And the discussion question is the core of our studies. So after reading what he has to read, he decided to contribute toward his original contribution to the class discussion. The next student, let's say that she's Indonesian, she does the same thing. She sees what the Chinese put, and she decides to comment on him. The third one is Saudi Arabian, and he does the same. And the fourth one is American, and she also comment. The Chinese is very likely to go back to the class to see what the other people, the virtual class obviously, had to say about his point. And all week long, every student must have at least one original contribution to the class discussion, at least five times comment on other students' points. So the discussion developed all week long under the supervision of the instructor, who reads everything that is happening in the classroom, and correct mistakes, answer questions if someone asks a question and nobody was able to answer, or maybe redirect the discussion.
Shall I stand by? I want to ask Maggie Daugherty, how do you provide the intimacy factor in our new you?
I think in my new you, the students would be in classrooms, because I think there's a kind of intimacy that is achieved by students encountering each other in person and looking each other in the eye. I'm thinking of a class I taught on new immigrant narratives that was mostly about for first-generation college students, first-generation Americans, immigrants themselves, and they read the stories of their family's immigration to each other. And seeing the emotion on their faces, hearing their voices quaver, was something that I don't know you can replicate online. And I think that's part of the support that Paul was talking about for these students that might feel a bit at sea in new learning environments. Being able to speak to each other, look at each other, find each other in those spaces feels to me absolutely integral to the educational experience of a new you.
What's the quavering voice the University of the People, Shai? It's an important thing to see somebody relating their own family story and emotionally challenged, threatened, excited about it is important.
I think it's extremely important. It's also important to have $250,000 to study in Harvard. Well, what happens if you don't have the money? So I don't think that the question is, what's the best possible education that we can give the children? The question is, how do we give them a quality education at a minimal price? Those who can afford Harvard, I would never argue that they shouldn't go there. Everyone who can afford elite university should study there. I would say even more than that, if someone would come to us ever and say, well, I'm not sure if I should go to Harvard or University of the People, I would start, I'm not sure if I would laugh or cry, because if that would be the case, we failed.
We're thinking up a new U, not least to address the discovery of many graduates of old U's that at best they got analog skills and habits of mind for a digital job world. There are makeup courses available now as a sort of bridge. This week, we visited Dan Pickett and Evan Charles, founders of Launch Academy. It's a 10-week computer programming boot camp in loft space in Boston's Chinatown. For $10,000 over 10 weeks, they offer the basics of web development and essentially guarantee a high-paying tech job within 3 months of finishing the program.
Today we're going to move forward with HTTP and Sinatra. You know, you'll build a functional web app at this point.
So I'll leave that type of feedback. What we like to do at Launch Academy is we like to say that we're giving the gift of loving what you do. So we train software developers over a 10-week period that's actually preceded by 8 weeks of interactive pre-learning. So they come here equipped with the basics of programming knowledge, so we can teach them what it's like to be a software developer in today's startups and mid-sized businesses.
The majority of CS programs in the United States teach approximately 10% practical applicable knowledge in their curriculum, and at least 90% theoretical knowledge. What we do here at Launch Academy is we just teach that 10% of practical applicable knowledge, and we do it in an immersive structure through a 10-week period so that when people graduate and they get on the job, they can add value day one.
As someone who graduated college 3 years ago and who saw the cost of education and what a four-year degree can get you, and seeing my classmates not being employed immediately after graduation, it's crazy to me that more people don't jump on something like this. It's a 10-week program, and we have about a 97% hire rate right now.
Just tell me your stories about where you were coming from, what wasn't working, and what this is going to do.
I have an extensive education that I had never planned on using once I graduated. I got a bachelor's degree in philosophy and a master's degree in philosophy, and then finally a law degree. And I used academia as in the worst way you could, which is as a shelter until you can really find what your professional calling is.
Starting your education again, how would you plan it differently?
I would have really, really questioned myself hard on whether it's worth going to college in the first place, what it would get me, and be very career-minded about it. As a career tool, it was totally useless. So,
I graduated from the University of Chicago a couple years ago. I majored in history and creative writing. I always liked making things and expressing myself creatively, and actually, I don't regret my majors at all. I loved it, and I loved the school, but the thing I found out when I graduated, when I realized I didn't actually want to do academia, is people with humanities degrees often don't make things or do creative work afterwards. The jobs they often end up shuffling paper around or trekking through bureaucracy or marketing things, and I wasn't making things anymore.
Well, I come from Seattle, and I don't have a college background, so I've been working entry-level jobs, and I had always written off college because I found academics to be somewhat asinine as far as using what you've learned as an actual skill. So what attracted me to Launch Academy was that the environment facilitates critical thinking. They were actually curious about how you think. Can you adapt? Can you learn? Can you be taught to learn? And so I'm here to show them I can, and hopefully I won't be working out in the rain anymore.
That was Launch Academy in Boston. We're assembling new you this hour on Open Source with Shai Reshef, who joins us from South Korea. He founded the University of the People. Also with Paul Tuff of the New York Times Magazine. Also with Maggie Doherty, who's finishing her PhD work at Harvard. We've also got Eloy Ortiz Oakley on the line. He's the president superintendent of Long Beach College in California. Very much engaged in redesigning community colleges nationwide. Dr. Oakley, you're the first stop for a vast numbers of students, many immigrants among them, who have no family history of higher learning and who, if they get stuck with just a high school diploma, could be stuck for life. And you were one of them once. What's going to get them to the finish line, maybe to the new you we're talking about?
Well, Christopher, thank you for that question, and thank you for having me on the show. It's been a wonderful discussion thus far. You know, for students throughout the country, our community colleges are the gateway to higher education. And as you said, we have to do a better job as a nation of preparing more individuals with some sort of post-secondary credential, some credential that allows them to navigate this new knowledge-based economy and allows our country to be much more competitive. So, you know, throughout the country, this discussion has been front and center, particularly since President Obama has highlighted community colleges as that that cornerstone of public education. And so we've been really focused on trying to reimagine our public institutions, our community colleges, to blur the lines between our K-12 partners and our university partners and really focus on meeting the students where they're at. You know, we can't rely on our old methods of teaching students. We have to meet them where they're at. We have to be available to them. We have to redesign our curriculum so that we can ensure that they have the opportunity.
But let's talk about how. First of all, I mean, 40% of the higher education population is in these community colleges. I think you could make an argument that the community college can be more helpful to more people for less money than maybe any other part of the system, but the completion rate is an embarrassment, and it's a problem. Address it.
Well, I'm not going to argue that the completion rate is not a problem, but it's also been a product of the way that we've looked at community colleges over the years. We've looked at community colleges over the years as a public policy, from a public policy standpoint, as a place where students can come in and out. Students can come out of the workforce if they lose their jobs, if they weren't sure what they were doing in high school. So we really became purely an open access institution, no admissions criteria. So we served and continue to serve the top 100% of students. So that made it very difficult to not only measure where students were along a continuum to an academic goal, but you know, neither did we have the tools, neither was there the impetus to measure these things.
But so what are we going to do? I mean, Sebastian Thrun says you got to make the curriculum irresistible, halfway addictive. Paul Tough says, I think that we really don't know what these young people need. We got to get to know them better. What are you doing?
Well, what we're doing, and I agree with Paul Tough, you know, a lot has to do with the messaging early on in their K-12 experience, because we're talking about students that have no family infrastructure on how to navigate higher education, and we've created barrier after barrier for students. So unless you have that infrastructure, you're going to get stuck. So one of the first things we do is ensure that we are communicating with students in the K-12, making sure they understand what the expectations are, making sure that we capture their high school experience using available data, and then placing them in the classes that they need, avoiding standardized placement exams, which tend to capture large portions of underrepresented students, and really focusing on putting them in classes, ensuring that we redesign remedial education because we are assigning way too many students who shouldn't be in these courses. We have students in remedial education courses who completed their high school math courses. And then we're telling them when they get to our community colleges that they weren't good enough. That's the kind of messaging that I think Paul Tough referred to. We're sending wrong messages. We need to give them credit for the work that they did, and we need to get them through our system as quickly as possible.
Paul Tough, I wonder if that meets your standard of getting to meet the real human needs of these young people.
Yes, I think it absolutely can. I mean, I think community colleges are a really important element of the new U and the higher education landscape right now. But I do think that there is a huge dropout problem, and I think it's true that some of that is about those remedial classes, especially the early math classes, developmental or remedial math classes that so many community college students are put in right at the beginning of their college career. In all sorts of ways, I think that's send students the message that they're not ready for college. And especially if, as so many community college students are, they're first-generation college students, that can be a real blow to their confidence. You know, they're already wondering whether they can belong on a college campus, and the first thing that they hear is, well, no, you're doing high school math. So I think some of the new approaches to developmental math that are giving students actually more challenging math early on in their community college career are exactly the right message. And that's something that I found at the University of Texas, that the right answer for students who were maybe struggling was not remedial classes, was not sort of to dumb things down or put them in easier sections. It was to give them challenging work, but also give them the support that they needed to be able to complete it.
But these colleges are being asked to fill gaps that really should have been attended to in high school. It's a tough assignment. But let me ask you, Dr. Oakley, why not call it Voc Ed, put kids out right out of high school into something like launch academies, and then right into the workforce, and say that's what we're doing?
Well, first of all, let me say, I think your point is well taken, that we need to prepare students for careers. Now, having said that, they should be college and career ready right out of high school, understanding that some of these students, many of these students, are going to have to change jobs well over a dozen times. We need to ensure that we prepare them in a way that they can navigate the economy, give them credentials that they can build upon. So if we give them a credential that gets them into a job, they can continue to build upon those credentials on their way to an associate's degree or to transfer to a university, so that the credits that they earn them value in the workforce and value going forward in their higher education career. Because many of these students will want to continue building, will want to continue moving forward, advancing in their career. Even though they get in with a good job right off the bat, they're going to want to continue to advance and are going to need to advance.
What do you do for the inner life of these kids, the liberal arts, the humanities, the human dimensions of their own lives, you know, lifelong?
Well, you know, this is really about a comprehensive quality education. And I think this is the beauty of our public higher education system, is that even though we're talking about getting these students ready for careers, we continue to value the humanities. We continue to ensure that they have a strong fundamental appreciation for these things that we know that all of our citizenry should have. So, and we continue to value those degrees as well. So I think looking at students not just as career-oriented or transfer-oriented, but making sure that they're all college and career-ready and give them as many options as possible. And we shouldn't just assume that these students, underrepresented students, first-generation students, just want to get a job. We shouldn't assume that they have a low bar of expectation. We should continue to push them to the highest bar of expectation and get them ready to achieve whatever they want to achieve.
Maggie Daugherty, how would you welcome them into New U?
So one thing that I found really gets students invested in their education is having a say in both what they learn and how they learn. This is those have been the courses that have been most successful in my experience, where students come in energized and motivated. And often it's surprising the kinds of students who want to learn sort of how to think, how to be in the world. We might think that those would only be for the most privileged students, but it's often not. There are students who I've taught to have learned what seemed like very esoteric things, postmodern theory. And I remember one of them turning to me and saying, I always knew the world was a complicated place. Now I know this to be true, and I now have the language in which to talk about it.
Fascinating. What about people have talked about paying kids to go to school, stay to school. In what sense is the promise of a job that lure?
I think I don't want to de-emphasize the idea that colleges should prepare students to make a living wage when they leave school. I think the fact that we're saddling students with student debt and then not giving them the tools to get out of that debt is almost unconscionable. But I also want to say that I think that one of the other important things that a university education should do is give students the tools to question a current economic system and the ability to propose changes to that economic system. I actually think this is something a university education education must do, because the world is not very good right now in that respect. And if we want to change the problems with high school education, with elementary education, we need students to leave college and go out into the world prepared to change the way the economic reality is at the moment.
I was going to say, what about teaching them to change their own economic reality? I was going to ask you, President Oakley, can you turn this situation around without restoring serious state funding that's been cut massively in the last 5-10 years?
Well, we can't underestimate the impact on our public institutions of the drastic cuts in many, many states, and California would be included. In California alone, we turned away, you know, over 500,000 students over 4 years of recession. So that's a serious impact. Now, however, that doesn't absolve us of doing everything we need to do to ensure that we graduate more students in less time. So, you know, we need to look at our own institutions. We need to reduce the number of credits that students have to take, ensure that the credits that they're taking are meaningful to their lives, their career, their transfer pathways. We need to become more efficient between our K-12 community college and higher education systems. You know, we've operated in silos far too long. We're all funded by the same public dollar. We need to work together and ensure that we are easing transfer. And we need to do a better job with data. The use of data is predominant now. We have access to data. We can customize the student's experience. We can do a better job of placing students in classes. And through the use of predictive analytics, we can do a much better job of improving the experience for every individual student.
Shai Rishav, I wanted to ask you, what part of your motivation, what part of your students' motivation is all about getting a job?
I think it's very important. I think that students are coming to us, at least, because they want to have a better future, and they believe that academic education and academic degree, accredited degree, will pave the way for them. I agree with everything that was said, that a higher education should emphasize and encourage the students to study not only the courses that will be directly toward their job, but to have a well-rounded education, strong fundamentals, to make the students a better people and with a chance for a better future, no matter what they choose to do. Saying that, they are coming in order to have to find a job, and we believe that it's our responsibility to prepare them for the real world and to help them find a job.
Shai Rishav, thank you in South Korea, and all the best to your University of the People. Thank you, Maggie Daugherty. Thank you, Paul Tuff. Thank you, Sebastian Thrun and Eloy Ortiz Oakley. Thanks also to Evan Charles, Dan Pickett, and Launch Academy in Boston, and to Michelle Wise at the Christensen Institute. Also to John Summers and The Baffler. Also to Richard Thomas for help with our Latin motto for New You. You can hear a longer excerpt of our conversation with Sebastian Thrun and another one with the former Harvard President Derek Bach on our website, radioopensource.org. Next week, we're reading Chekhov with Andre Debus III and others. Our show this week was produced by Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and our engineer, George Hicks. Mary McGrath is the dean of our college. I'm the provost, Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
I find that education, I think it don't matter where you go to school, Italy, America, Brazil, it's all the same. It's all just memorization. And it don't matter how long you can remember anything, just so you can pair it at the back for the test. And I got this idea for a school I would like to start. Something called the 5-Minute University. And the idea is that in 5 minutes, you learn what the average college graduate remembers 5 years after he or she's out of school.